concept of the potential field, and what he did was assimilate obstacles to objects charged with electricity, which emanated an electric field, and so that when the robot was approaching the object, the obstacle, the potential field would increase to going to infinity when colliding with the object. And this became afterwards a quite appreciated tool in motion programming. So what Usama Khatib has been doing in robotics is quite multifaceted, I would say. He has been actively working in robotics research, besides organizing conferences, organizing societies, organizing the Handbook of Robotics more recently. Together with Bruno Siciliano, Usama Khatib is a co-editor of the Handbook of Robotics, which received the Prose Award of the American Association of Book Publishers in 2008. Without much ado, I will ask Professor Khatib to tell us about robots among humans.
Thank you so much for this kind introduction. It is really a great pleasure. So how do we use this? It's really a great pleasure to be back. You know, the first time I came to McGill was not quite 25 years ago, but it was 21 years ago. And in fact, I have some pictures. That year, we organized the first ISER conference called International Symposium of Experimental Robotics, which was organized for the first time here and brought probably the most active researchers in robotics to McGill. I don't have all the photos, just 10 minutes ago I found some of them. So this is a photo of the group, and probably you recognize the background. This is, where is this? The arts building, okay. And maybe you will not recognize the organizer from this big photo, so I have a closer look. This is Vincent Hayward. I'm next to him. And you have Gerd Herzinger and many other colleagues from who really were the pioneers in robotics. These are some others from Toulouse, in fact, this group. And another group, while having lunch in a sunny day, I believe this is one of the active researchers at the Canadian Space Agency. And I like this photo. This is with Gerd Herzinger and myself discussing very important topics about robotics. So robotics has evolved a lot, and in fact robotics was never conceived as something that is going to connect that much to the human. We always thought about robotics as the tool to improve automation, to bring robots to make cars, make things that we don't want to spend time just repeating the same tasks over and over. And by the 90s, we started to see a maturity of the field in terms of the methodologies, the algorithms, and many aspects of robotics. That is bringing us to the challenge of robotics. The challenge of robotics is not really in manufacturing, in that in manufacturing you just need to repeat the same task. You can reprogram everything when you have a small change. But essentially, it is pre-programmed. And essentially, you are dealing with the fixtures and all the tools that you are using to deal with this structured environment. But human environment is much more challenging. It's quite messy, and you have all kind of changes happening all the time. It's a dynamic environment. And bringing robots to assist work, interact with the human, is a big challenge. So this is not quite yet there, but actually humanoid robotics are coming closer and closer to be part of the human environment, and we have one of those at Stanford in my lab. As we come closer to the human, we are faced with challenges. The challenges are that it's not enough to move, to create locomotion. We need robots that can really do useful things. So Ashimo is one of the best robots. It could climb these stairs without falling. It can run. It can do a lot of things. But the question, can it interact with the world? Touching the environment, interacting with the environment is challenging because it creates all kind of feedback, reaction forces that requires us to create controllers that would deal with those reaction forces, and that is not going to be easy if we are developing a controller that is only based on dealing with the motion. So often controllers for robots like the humanoid robots are designed to move, to locomote, to create the locomotion, but then to deal with a contact, we create another controller. To deal with obstacles, we create another, a third controller. And then we try to merge them. And those controllers start to fight each other. So really the challenge is, can we build a unified framework to deal with the whole, with the problem of whole body control of those systems? And this is one of really the biggest challenges in terms of creating robots that are going to be eventually useful. So can we interact between, can we create interaction between the environment and the robot? Can we deal with that reaction force that is going to create it every time we touch the environment? Because we now are going to move in contact. And how can you move in contact unless you deal with the dynamic of the contact and the reaction forces created? We do perceive the environment. We have a lot of now tools to perceive the free space motion. But can we perceive the contact space? Can we develop SLAM in contact? Can we have tactile SLAM? Can we make sure that our robots are safe? And safety is something that is going to be very, very important now because we are dealing with interaction with human. And all of these brings a number of challenges. I'm summarizing some of them. So sensing and perception in terms of the unstructured nature of our environment, the planning and control in terms of the multitude of degrees of freedom that we have, and the need to create behavior that are similar to those of the human that requires us to build architecture that are much more complex and unified in terms of the perception they are processing and the control they are delivering. The human-robot interaction itself needs to be understood not in terms of just the physical interaction, but also in terms of the cognitive interaction. And finally, we need to make sure that we are building robots that can be useful, and to make these robots useful to the human, they have to be safe. But safety is not sufficient unless we are able to combine safety and performance. And this is really the challenge that we need to address, combining safety together with performance. So in all of these different challenges, what we can see is the underlying requirement for interactivity and the underlying requirement for building robots that are human-centered, human-friendly. So I'm going to start with safety. Hi, Sammy. So, Sammy, would you like to stand next to this robot? Oh, it is scary, right? So you wouldn't stand next to this robot unless this robot is shut down. And this was the concept. The concept with the industrial robot was to say, well, essentially, if a human is next to the robot, we're not going to allow the robot to move. And if the robot is moving, no human is allowed. The separation between the workspaces of the human and the robot would solve the problem of safety. Actually, we even put protection to make sure that even if the robot breaks, it will not send parts over to the other side. Now, bringing robots next to the human, yes, requires safety. But as I said, the challenge is safety and performance, because the two are always competing. As you design for safety, you are competing with performance. Now, what kind of safety we're talking about? We're talking about safety of the order of the safety of a machine like the human. So what characterizes human motion and human safety? Well, you have masses that are moving, and if you consider the inertial properties of the hand as it moves, you can measure it with some effective mass that we could normalize to the load that could be carried. And I'm going to use this to compare it with something a lot of you who work with the Puma, many of you knows probably the Puma, and look at these indices. So for the human, the index is 0.04, and for the Puma, it's 30 times higher. 30 times higher, this is coming from the fact that we have a transmission, a gear that is amplifying by the square of the gear ratio, the characteristics of the rotor inertia, and this is amplified, multiplied by the arm at the hand and producing a large effective inertia. So, as long as we have robots built with the same technology that we use to build industrial robotics, we're not going to come closer to the human. We need to think differently about the design. And we looked at the design in terms of different characteristics. We looked at it in the frequency domain, and we came up with ideas that separate the requirement. What is needed for lifting is at low frequency. The heavy weights are at most of the time at low frequency. The requirement at high frequency do not require us to have large magnitude in the torques. And we built several prototypes that demonstrated safety characteristics very close to that of the human. I will discuss specifically S2RO, a robot that we are building with bones, muscles, and skin, almost like the human, with safety characteristics that are quite amazing for a robot with the capacity that this one has. So this robot is modeled after a human arm, actually my own, and this robot has the capacity almost of the Puma, but this robot is very capable of performing fine motion force control, because we integrated, in addition to the pneumatic muscles, we integrated an electrical motor that deals with all the requirement of the dynamics. And here's this first experiment with this robot. It is making contact, controlling the forces, and at the same time, it is a very light 1.2 kilogram robot, where the Puma is 20 kilogram robot. So from that initial experiment, we started integrating a lot of aspects of the next prototype using shape deposition manufacturing technology, and we built a system that integrates everything, removing connectors, removing all the cables, and putting everything together in a system with more pressure amplifiers to have more muscles, and covering the whole thing with skin. Now, this skin is sensitive skin, and this robot is just a few weeks ago found the shoulder. We added the shoulder, and the hands are coming from a company actually based in San Francisco called Mecca Robotics. And this robot has characteristics of safety almost like those of the human, with the skin that is being developed. The skin is aimed at bringing protection at after the first contact, and then measuring the contact, where the contact is, the normals, and also being able to go further than the human by measuring the distance. So we can measure proximity to obstacles as we are moving. So This is an example, I believe, of what we would like to see in the future designs of robots. So we are building humanoid robots. These are platforms to develop controllers, to understand sensing, to develop the methodologies. But eventually, to deploy these robots, we need new technologies, we need new kind of robot mechanisms that can guarantee safety so that we can really put them in proximity of the human. Well, our exploration of the human environment started long ago, and started with Romeo and Juliet, where we were not looking at building a robot like the human, but we were looking at the functionalities of manipulation in the human environment, so it's mobile manipulation, together with human-guided motion. So you can see on the left here, human-guided motion produced just by touch, and the robot's ability to interact and work with multiple robots, like in here, while moving, touching, controlling internal forces, controlling contact, ironing. This is my shirt. It was, I think, the only shirt ironed by a robot. So, in fact, this project, which was culminating by the around 97, was coming at the same time when Honda brought P2, if those of you would remember. P2 was the first surprise to the robotics community with a robot that can really walk stably. And Honda came with the challenge, asking us to explore capabilities like those we put in Romeo and Juliet in a robot like Ashimo. Well, how about two Ashimos or three Ashimos? How can we do extend the work that we did with an open chain structure, an arm with a mobile robot, it's an open chain structure, to a branching complex. So you move one arm, you are affecting all the other branches, and you have balance, you have under actuation, you have all kind of issues. You need to also create interactivity, not at one point, but at multiple points. You need to control a task that involves motion together with contact at multiple points on multiple links. You need to do that under constraints, internal constraints, external constraints, obstacles, while doing the balance. And you still have freedom to deal with postures that are left to be controlled. So you have a sort of a hierarchy of tasks that needs to be addressed. And as I said, it needs to be addressed in a unified fashion. So we need to create a whole body controller with constraints that involve contact, and we need to deal with the internal forces and balances. And obviously the exploration of all of these different aspects would take a lot of time to discuss, but I'm going just to summarize the concept and explain that essentially what we have done, we started with the concept of task and posture decomposition, where a task is performed and a posture is controlled with an independent controller, but that controller is guaranteed not to interfere with the task by projecting it in the null space of the task. And by doing so, we created the first hierarchy between a task and a posture, which was extended as we moved to all these other hierarchy and constraints. So, as Professor Angelos said earlier, the concept, the basic concept of all of this is very simple. It is a concept that is based on almost like human-like behavior. When we are moving to a goal position, what do? If you want, I can show you. We can explore this on this robot. So, I need help. Which arm would you like to move? The right one or the left one? Right. Okay. About here? Okay. So, how do we do this motion? Well, in robotics, in industrial robotics, the way we do this is by imagining where is the final configuration, making a commitment to that final configuration, and then interpolating between the two in terms of the joints. So, I'm wondering if any of you would do that. Do you do inverse kinematics when you're moving? I doubt it. I think I think most of us, what we do is we visually serve our hand to the ball. If we have a tennis racket, we visually serve the location, that task to hitting the ball eventually, if we know how to play, if we acquire that skill. But in here, what we're going to do is create an attractive force to pull this hand here, and this force will be generated by all the motors through a simple transformation, Jacobian transpose. So this is moving, and now we can move one arm, we can move the second one, and we can even move both of them and a number of them and a number of different things. So the robot is doing another thing. It is balancing. It is controlled with us. The posture controller that is decoupled from this one. And in fact, if we cut the power, it's going to fall and break itself. Now it broke one arm because it went through a singularity, but it's quite robust. Wow, I'm impressed. So the constraint of singularity wasn't there on that one. And this robot is quite interactive. You can see that this task is maintained when I'm modifying the posture. So if I pull on the hair, you see the posture is not changed. If I pull here, the position is not changed. And we can pull anywhere. It is quite interactive. Okay, so this is the concept, the basic concept that we are talking about. It's a concept where we create a task field, task-like field, a posture-like field. The two are decoupled. We generate motion without trajectories. But those motions need to be found, compatible, inspired by the motion of the human. We would like to understand how human moves so that we can capture the characteristic of human motion and map them to the robot. So we started a study on a skeletal model of a human, and from those studies you can understand the kinematic, the dynamic part, but you also need to understand the control part. You need to understand the muscular motor control, and to do that we need to go further and analyze how actually a human control these muscles to produce the motion. And this study went through a lot of hard work by the students, holding tasks and trying to understand why we will be in this posture rather than that posture, how do we move from one location to another. And what we find as we examine more and more tasks is that essentially human in tasks that are learned, what we do is we really discover and know how to use the machine, the human machine. And we do it in a way that takes advantage of all the properties, the way muscles are transmitted to the task. The way we are going to move is going to be affected by all these models we learned and exercised over time. So we balance the effort between muscles. The conclusion is, if we have a task, essentially we are going to use the mechanical advantage. I call it physiomechanical advantage because physiology is a very important part. In addition to using the length of our limbs, we are also using the knowledge about the routing of those muscles in the structure. And this comes from the descriptions of those characteristics. That is, essentially, if we really are making use of the physiomechanical advantage, we are maximizing the transmission from muscles to the task, which means that we are minimizing the effort of the muscles. So we are minimizing the muscular effort in those skilled tasks, and in fact, there are a lot of constraints, including social constraints. It's easier to move the head to the spoon, but mom says, no, it's not polite. So you will not perform that task because it is easier, and humans perform a lot of those tasks under certain constraints. But we can see the role of physiology in motion, and we can capture it by looking at that criteria associated with that minimization. So our speculation was that we are minimizing the effort associated with muscles. So let's take one muscle and imagine that the tension of that muscle is M. If we are minimizing the effort, it's going to be a minimization of a criteria in M squared. But we have many muscles associated with that motion, so we need some weighting. And the weighting we found was a weighting associated with the capacity of that muscle. In fact, our speculation is that the energy being minimized is... Are you ready for this? Are you sure? This is what you're doing every day. I mean, you don't know... He's a good hockey player, but this is what you're doing. So, if we generalize this, this is actually a quadratic form on the task. F is your task, and phi is that space where you have the physiology, the kinematics, everything that is connected to that criteria. Now, I can show you this here, but we don't really have time to run through it because it's a good time to have a cup of tea. If you drink a cup of tea, you're not going to do it this way. The cup is here, your arm is here. It's not there. Why? Well, the answer is very simple. This corresponds to the minimum of that energy. In fact, as you move, you reach 42, 43 degrees. And if we increase this weight, this angle is going to go up and up and up and up, and it moves with the weight. And this corresponds again to the minimum of that energy. If we analyze the human body, so this kind of criteria is capturing the fact that we really are doing something. We're just capturing the characteristics which we can use now in our model, and you can see how we are reconstructing this motion. This is a full dynamical motion of a full 79 degrees of freedom human that we are controlling, balancing, using abstractions with characterization of the motion and their criteria. Once we have this, we can map it to the robot. The robot is going to follow that motion, not by copying the trajectory, but by taking these characteristics in its own context. So we apply this to Ashimo, and Ashimo now is moving, and as Ashimo moves, you can see the fluidity of the motion. It's not going from one joint position to another. It's quite fluid because it's following a goal, it is adjusting the posture, and it is moving in that way. Now, this is not going to work unless we deal with a lot of other things related to constraints. And constraints involve collision, so we need to find collision between objects. So we developed algorithms to find collision between objects very quickly, very efficient algorithms to resolve those collisions. Here you're going to see thousands and thousands of collisions taking place and resolved. And what is amazing, they are resolved in real time. Now, once we have this, we can, in fact, apply this in haptic interaction to simulate environments that are very complex, to go all the way to the human, touch the human, and reconstruct the surface that we are touching. And we can go further, use that to teach and acquire skills from the human and move them to the robot through teaching the robot in the virtual world. You can use it in a lot of useful things. This is a short video illustrating a phantom that is being used to illustrate a pregnant woman ultrasonic examination where the robot was taught only 2-3 points on the body, and the robot now is building the ultrasonic imaging and producing a 3D image that can be used directly for the examination. And without the pain and the risk of injury to the operators, the people who, the sonographs, they suffer 2-3 years later, they suffer a lot of problems with their wrist by the amount of pressure they are putting. And here, a robotic device can be adjusted to every subject and produce the 3D imaging. Well, I was saying we need to detect collision, we need to produce those collisions, but now we need to integrate that into the controller so that the robot can integrate those constraints in the motion. And that brings us to how we move this body to avoid hitting the hand that is moving a lot along a trajectory. Well, this is done again in the same way we did it with the posture. We elevate the constraint of not touching as a representation to the top, and now we are producing a motion that is consistent with that constraint. We need to control the constraints, so we need to push the body, and this is done through the artificial potential field directly in the part of the control of the constraints. And the rest of the motion is done in the null space associated with that constraint. The same thing here with obstacle. So the obstacle is pushing the head, pushing the part. Actually, I should show you this because I think I have it here. So here is the robot standing. Here is an obstacle. And wow, I have no battery. Oh, okay, let me connect the battery before we lose everything. So do we have is this a source? Could you use here? We need an electrical output.
An electrical engineer.
Maybe two. It is about exploration, finding what that is. Okay. Fantastic, thank you. We are saved. Oh, thank you. Okay, we're back. Okay, so now, if you have an obstacle and this obstacle is moving closer and closer and you do not want to hit it with your head, it's not a wall you're going to, you want really to avoid it. We need to plan all the motions. But here what we're going to do is to create a constraint on the robot that it can control itself, but not in directions associated with the constraint. So automatically the robot will move. If we go to the other side, the robot is going to do the same thing. Actually, I think it is far away in the other side, so I need to move it a little bit here. It is 3D. So you see all that motion without any planning. So in fact, if we have that kind of behavior integrated with the control, so we can integrate this behavior as a constraint, and as we will see, all constraints of that type involving self-collision, involving external obstacle, involving joint limits, internal constraints, can be treated in that way. Now, there is a big problem in robotics related to how we connect local with the global. And I'm not going really to have a chance to talk about it, just to say we are over like almost 7-8 years we've been working on this problem involving a mechanism that we call the elastic strip, which capture a tunnel of the free space associated with the robot and modify it in real time as obstacle and non-obstacles move in this environment. This was actually extended to non-holonomic robots and to all kind of other application that requires very complex planning. The planning for a robot like this one would take hours. And what we are being able to do is to modify this plan in real time. So I'm going to talk a little more about a very difficult problem, which is the fact that in addition to all these constraints, we have a robot that is under-actuated. It's under-actuated by the fact that if you think about this robot, it's not connected to the ground, but the freedom of motion is there. So what do? We balance. We have something called like ZMP, zero moment point, that is being controlled to maintain balance. But with the ZMP, you cannot address the problem of contact. If you make a contact, you're going to tip the robot over. And unless we are able to create motions that are consistent with those contacts, we will not be able to produce any behavior that integrates motion together with contact and force control. And you can see here a motion that is taking place, and the contacts are just treated in the same way as we treat obstacles, constraints. So we take those normals and we treat them as constraints, and we add to them the knowledge of the internal forces produced between contact. So we model internal forces that are associated with the robot. And the result is a system where we essentially are able to, again, I will show you this interactively. So when we're going to move to the contact, you see the contact, and now you're going to see the reaction forces coming and balanced once we satisfy those conditions. And now, in fact, we can see how the reaction forces are adjusted all the time. So if I apply a force here, look at the reaction forces. Immediately they are adjusted, moved, and changed in real time to accommodate the specifications and requirement for the balance. So by putting all these components together in one controller, actually what we do, we end up with a representation in high-dimensional space of all these constraints, where a posture is consistent with the task, consistent with the contact, consistent with the constraint and the balance, and all of these are in just one vector in this high-dimensional space that is associated with the projections, successive projections in those null spaces, from which you can, I'm sorry for the equation, don't worry, it's high-dimensional space, you can produce a dynamic equation, and once you have a dynamic model, you can have a controller. And this controller has to be adapted to the under-actuation, and you obtain behavior that are completely consistent with each other. Now, just to show you, so the robot is moving up and down, you can see that moving up and down, but at the same time, this robot, as it's moving, is controlling pressure, so you cannot see it, but it is shown here with these step responses, and everything is responding consistently with the other. There is no interference between them. And if you break anything immediately, you break the contact, and the robot will tip over. Another important thing about those systems is that it's not enough to look at your simulations. Simulations are fantastic to develop the framework, to examine variables you don't have access to do a lot of things, but then you need to implement this on the physical robot. And one of the things about physical robots and industrial robots is the fact that they are all the time controlled with joint position servo loops. And how can we implement torque controllers? Well, this was another big project that led to a solution to transform torque into position that is based on a transformer. And this transformer was the basis for the implementation on ASHIMO of our compliant motion force control and all the techniques that we will get a chance to see. But here you can see the tracking of the controllers following the transformer, almost perfect tracking, allowing us to do the force control. This is just a small description of one part of this system where we are looking at just the whole body coordination that is consistent with each of the specifications that are coming from the planning and dealing with the real-time constraints. So in here we have the line of action, in here we have the line of perception, and in here we have very fast servo loops, slower and slower and slower as we move up. And what we are doing is we take a plan, we modify it in real time with the feedback that is coming about object normals and information, and then we send it as in high-dimensional space to this level where we are able now to control a complete local behavior that is transformed into a controller. So a task like this one is implemented in one primitive. And we are not programming each of the joints, we are programming high-level tasks to perform this operation, and that is consistent with all the requirement and specification that include the environment. The environment is included in this feedback. So the robot lives in virtual environment and explore it. So we have the robot moving, interacting with different objects, and we explore that virtual environment. And at the same time, we are implementing the results into the physical environment. So one incredible thing that happened on the way, as you study humanoid robots, you discover that we are going to observe a human and then use them to help us control the robot, so the robots are moving in consistency with the human and moving in ways that is acceptable to the human. Now, but we now develop models that are very useful to examine the human independently of the robots. And we started our study taking this further, analyzing how in sport we move, whether these ideas about minimization of energy is there. And what was amazing is that these characteristics we studied in static configurations are true in those dynamic motion. So if we take that energy and look at that phi and take the eigenvectors of phi, we see the motion along the minimum axis of phi. Another interesting thing that that is really remarkable in human is that in robotics, one thing we always pay attention to is not to saturate actuators. The motors are limited. You have minimum bounds and maximum bounds on your motor torque, which confines your torque vector to a box. Well, you can, through the model, map this box to another box in acceleration space. And the result for the Puma is that you can move, accelerate, can accelerate much more in this direction than this direction. Well, look at the human. Well, if we look at the human, here are the line of acceleration. In this throwing, the human is using the line of acceleration to maximize the momentum and move and come up with the maximum acceleration. In fact, we do not throw this way. We throw this way because we are following this line of motion. So now from this, we can go and build a sort of atlas characterizing the line of acceleration, and these lines could be, what is interesting, these are specific to every person. So these are subject specific. So it is not enough to observe, who's your favorite tennis player? Well, it's not enough if you copy that motion, it's not going to work for you. You have to adapt it to your own line of accelerations. So for each person, we can go and look at that hierarchy of the human. We put markers, and now we observe the motion, and we reconstruct in the marker space in the same way we control task. Now we create task in the marker space, and we track the motion in the marker space perfectly. Once we track those motions in the marker space, we can analyze the characteristics. Oh, this is another marker tracking. This is an African dance that I was in South Africa, and we had a project to reconstruct African dances. And from this motion, immediately you have the reconstruction. And then you can characterize it and replay it in other conditions and different situations. But the point is, once you are able to do this whole thing in real time, from marker tracking to characteristic analysis, then you can feedback to the human corrections. And on the human now, we can have stimuli, vibration or skin stretching devices to direct the human to move up and down to make the corrections needed in learning, in actually re-education. We are working with a surgeon in knee injury, re-education of in walking, or even just skill teaching. Well, I'm going to conclude with this video that we shot like very, very recently of Ashimo finally interacting taking the first steps to interact with people. And one of the things that you learn when you go to an ASHRMO exhibition is that they tell you there is one rule: do not touch the robot. And what we are telling them, you can't touch the robot. And you can't touch the robot because it's completely compliant. This is position control. We fool the robot to think it is controlling the position, but actually it is controlling zero torque. It's controlling just the gravity forces. It is able to feel those forces and reproduce that motion, go up and down, and move in that complex interaction with the human. So with this, a lot of students, a lot of people, I mean many PhDs would take a long list to... Let's go. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the very nice presentation. We have time for questions.
Yes.
Yeah, question about the elastic planning algorithm. So you say it goes in real time, so it should be fairly computationally efficient. I'm wondering if you can distribute that computation, sort of like your spinal systems to help maintain balance and defense. Yeah. Is the computation...
You're giving me a new idea now. Continue, please.
That's my favorite. Can you distribute this in the same way that, you know, the body has distributed motor control?
Actually, the body is amazing. I mean, when you think about it, we have fantastic tools. I have my computer, and I'm computing the exact Jacobian, I'm computing the exact distances. The human are mapping this with a very simple neural network, trying to fit characteristics, complex functions in that somehow in those templates. And now we have an idea about a world coming. We invoke some controller, but then we start doing the adjustment lower. So there is a planning, and then there is the adjustment that is taking place, and there is and then there is even lower reflexes that are taking place. In robotics, what we have been trying to do was to break this cycle of saying, okay, I give you a plan, I have a planning system that will generate a plan, and then you execute it. Well, you give me a plan, you spend a lot of time computing this plan, and suddenly there is a small object on the way, the whole plan is finished. You need to, especially most of the plans are computed in joint space. You go to configuration spaces, it is like completely crazy. The representation of the obstacles are different, everything is different. So what we tried to do was to say, okay, we're going to the execution, we're going to integrate reactivity with respect to obstacle in the execution. So the reflexes include that ability to move away from obstacles. But then we're going to tell the planner, don't plan just simple motion. Plan knowing that I am able to do this. Which means that at higher level, we're going to have much better functions to plan with. That is, we will plan now with the knowledge that we are going to modify the plan. I have the capability to avoid local obstacles, and I have those abilities integrated in the way we are planning. When we move little up, we are saying, I'm receiving a plan, but I'm going to modify it. How can I modify it? Well, the modification of the plan is based on a very simple concept. I need to know about the free space. And let's model the local free space. I don't care about the free space there. So I model the free space around each configuration of the plan. And at each configuration of the plan, I have the ability now to modify. And then incrementally, I propagate that free space. So that is the mechanism where we are moving towards something like the human, where we incrementally increase the reactivity. Following, the key to understand is that what is critical is what rate of perception feedback I have and what time of reaction I have, and to create controllers that are consistent with that ability. And what we want to do is to create those levels as a function of the feedback processing we have. At the lowest level, we have encoder distances, but as we move up, then we have object and people and recognition of the world model. And we are not going to rely on the real world model to do any reactivity or modification. Yes?
Right. Can a robot figure out how to do that? Or
yes.
Is it more of a
programming? Very good question. Learning is going to be one of the most important aspects of teaching the humanoid how to really behave in the context of human tasks. And learning skills, learning all these things. Now, what we are doing is to really help bring learning to the right level. We do not want to go in a process where we try to teach the robot from a perception of the motion of the two fingers to controlling all the joint motors to produce some behavior. Learning from the joint all the way to the task is very, very complex. And this is some, in fact, this is being done by some early work in learning, and the results are always specific to that motion, to that robot, to. So we should implement learning, skill learning, at the right level. What we have done here was to elevate the controller to a level where you are controlling a task. And this task, you can now take the robot away. And now you can think about the interaction between the strategy that you are using in grasping, moving this object, and putting this object on the table. And do that synthesis of the skill integrated in a controller that will take care of the rest. So what we are trying to do is to put a structure that helps the robot to go to that level of task and skill and behavior, rather than trying to give the robot instructions to move its joints, and hopefully it will produce that motion or that behavior or that that play by going to all these joint angles.
I guess what I meant more was, can the robot learn on its own, or does it require the still the programming elements? Do you mean, is there
yes, yes, yes. Well, the framework that we have developed is allowing us to move to that level. We started teaching the robot behaviors like how to move to a goal position, how to exert a force, we taught already the robot how to put an object on the table. How do you do that? Actually, if you think about it, it is amazing, because for a machine, a robot to go and put this on a table, it is really a hard task. And humans use a very, very simple strategy. Again, a strategy that is based on compliance. We control the center of compliance here. So if you push here, it rotates. If you push here, it rotates in this way. All that you need to do is just to push down. You detect from the model the direction of rotation, and you go there. And this is implemented. So we implement a lot of closed form learning strategies. Energy-like criterion that are representing strategies learned from the human.